the numbers are positive. The fourth book is positive. So this is the fourth book of Moses. Anyway, so the fourth book of Moses is Numbers. That's kind of a weird name. We use the English translation that we use comes from the Latin and the Greek. And I don't remember what it is in Greek, but it's because when the book starts out, God tells Moses to take a census and count all the people. And so there's all these numbers that come through the book at the beginning and then toward the end. And so that gave it its name, the Book of Numbers. In Hebrew, however, it's called the Midar, which means the wilderness, which actually makes a lot more sense. Because, of course, the people are in the wilderness. We've been in the wilderness, since Exodus. And Leviticus, of course, is in the wilderness. And just like, the people are in the wilderness, it's now, we're going to start like a couple of years after they left Egypt. It's still not the Canaan. They don't know it yet. We'll find out later in this book. But they have 38 more years to go. The book is Nessa. And everybody who's over the age of 20 when they leave Egypt dies in the desert. In fact, God describes it very not poetically. He says they're comfortable, they're going to drop in the desert because they were unfaithful. So the only people who got it, and that included Moses, although Moses didn't know that at the time. So only Joshua and Caleb got into the promised land. And they were over 20 when they left Egypt. Everybody else died in the wilderness. So they were a stiff-necked people, like we are. And of course, they wandered in a wilderness, and we're wandering in a wilderness. This is the big lesson from Numbers, when you think about it. They wandered around in a literal wilderness, going to a promised land. We're on our way to heaven, which is the promised land, but our wilderness is living in this life. And you have to wander around, and sometimes you screw up, and sometimes you have to get punished and disciplined and pruned, and sometimes you do well, and you make progress, and then you don't make progress for a while. So, it's just equivalent for the years to get there. Some people get there in 100 years, some people get there in 2 years, whatever it is. We're wandering in the wilderness in temporary tents, just like they lived in temporary tents. Temporary tents. I don't know if I called tents. Anyway, the Hebrew word comes from the word wilderness. And we're going to read a little bit of this, not like we did with Leviticus, but if you remember, Ron, you got the 12 tribes. And now they've been out of Egypt. When this takes place, they've been out of Egypt for 2 years. And they haven't really gotten very far. And now, as when Exodus ends, all the things in the tabernacle are made. The tents made, the ark made, all the holy, the altars, the menorahs, everything's made the way God commanded it to be made. And you remember that God said, I'm making this stuff so I'm going to dwell with you, and I'm going to give you the exact dimensions and specifications of how everything is to be built. This is not up to you. Nothing is about us. It's all about Him. Nothing is about us. And so everything is made now and set up in the way that He wants it made and set up. And this is going to be important because later is going to be how the temple is going to be made. And then much later it's going to be how this church is going to be made to God is the same. When you walk into a church, you see the tabernacle and you see the temple. The early Christians didn't just make a church. Oh, let's put this over here. They made it according to these specifications. and the most, and is quite important, is failure. Of course. Because if Jesus hadn't been for a while, he can't be the Messiah. Jesus would have broken laws, but he didn't come. So everything came from there. And of course, the guys who first did everything were all Jewish believers. And when Gentiles started coming in, the time went on. But God tells Moses to take a census. So somebody start reading chapter 1. Verse 1, and the Holy Spirit tells Moses to write exactly when this is happening. Somebody go.
In the year following that of the Israelites, by departing from the land of Egypt, on the first day of the second month, the Lord took him up and the demons went to the desert of Sinai. Take a census of the whole community of Israel by clans and inquest to their house, residents from each male individual. You and Aaron shall enroll and produce all the men in Israel, 20 years or more, who are fit for military service. If 15 years shall be a man from each tribe, the head of the day, 6 years old.
Pause there. Okay, so it's the second month of the second year. God says you're going to take a census. You're going to count every male who's over the age of 20 and who can go to war. So a crippled guy, you don't count him. Somebody who's mentally retarded and can't fight, you don't count them. And you know why? You count all the males 20 years old and above that can go to war. Kind of interesting, right? And Moses and Aaron have to organize this and run it. And in order to have, because remember, there's a lot of people there. This isn't like counting, 100 people in a building. There's going to be one person from each tribe that's going to be involved in this. Double check the numbers. Then you're going to register everybody according to their fathers and their families. Because genealogy is very, very important to the people. Very, very important. For one reason, you have to decide who's a member of the people or not. You have to make sure you don't count foreigners. You don't want to be contaminated by foreigners. You can't have some filthy Gentiles that counted. You have to be hanging around. And, of course, the tribe of Levi has to be the priests and the men who do the ministry with. No other tribe can do that. Right? Except you from the tribe of Levi. Because the tribe of Levi was not involved in making the golden calf except for Aaron. They're the only ones that said we're not doing anything to do with it. God rewards that by making them the priests. So you count everybody over the age of 20. And the men over the age of 20, and whether they can go to war or not. The Levites are going to get counted separately, as we're going to see. But remember, the promise to Abraham was land, descendants, everybody on the earth was going to be blessed by you. If you go to Galatians 3:13, it says those promises now apply to the Gentiles because of what Jesus did. Because Jesus became a curse and died on a tree, we now get the promises made to Abraham. But now Abraham, I can tell you about his immediate descendants, but now he's got lots of descendants, because now we're like 450 or 470 years later, so they've reproduced quite a bit. So, very important that they're going to count. Now, we're going to skip who the little helpers are going to be, because we don't have to know that. I mean, these guys got this job. And so there's basically, suffice it to say, there's a guy from each of the tribes. So somebody start reading at 17.
17?
Yeah.
So Moses and Aaron took these men that had been distributed and assembled the whole community on the first day of the second month. Every man of 20 years or more, then declared his name and lineage according to clan and ancestral house, like the Lord had commanded Moses. This is
the entrance of Haven in the desert of Sinai. Okay. So, we'll get to that in a second. Where do you think about this? What does this remind you of? Yeah. Amen, brother. Where do you hear about somebody's got to go someplace and found it right now? And the Romans made the census. The Romans made the census and said, you all have to go to the place where your family comes from. In other words, you have to go where your ancestors are, where your family was, to be conquered. So Joseph and Mary, of course, I don't know how, why they were in Nazareth, because they were both from the line of David, so they were both from the tribe of Judah. The Judah was centered in Bethlehem, which is the city of David. So they had to go all the way from Nazareth to Bethlehem to be counted. So God set it up, used this, you know, pagan emperor to get everything set up. So they would end up there. Mary was 9 months pregnant because they had to make sure that the prophecy in Micah chapter 5 verse 2 was came through. The Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. Nothing happened randomly. And Caesar Augustus didn't have a clue that he was involved in the plan of salvation. He was pretty much like a threat. If somebody would have said, well, your highness, isn't it nice that you're going to help bring the Messiah into the world, probably would have put him in prison. So this is a thing that when you hear it's an echo, you have to go get registered with your tribe. This is a prefigurement of that. You have to go where your people are to be counted. Now, starting in verse 20, it begins to tell you the number of each of the tribes that there were. Now, we don't have to read that in detail, but let's look. Reuben was the firstborn. Remember, he was Jacob's first son. He was Leah's son. And he opened the first Jewish deli, and that's why he has a sandwich named after him. So he became the most famous of the boys. So you see, Israel's firstborn. So there were 46,500 people, or I should say men above the age of 20 who could fight, that were Reubenites. Doesn't count the women, doesn't count the children, doesn't count the 19-year-old men. You know exactly how many there were. Then you go to Simeon, who was the next one. Also, Leah was his mother, but we don't care about that. And there's 59,300. And, you know, I don't know why the Holy Spirit wants this included in the scripture. Be great for trivia questions. So how many men from the tribe of Simeon are there? If you know that, you're really sure. So if you really know the Bible, you'd pipe right up and say 59,300. Everybody would be impressed. So it goes through each of these tribes. See, Gad, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. Now Joseph gets divided between Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, poor Joseph, you know, the guy was awesome. Very big Joseph. Not really the other one. But he did Joseph. And he did all that stuff in Egypt. Then he forgave his brothers, brought the people to Egypt, got into Goshen, got them all settled in, saved everybody's life. You remember, Job did a really good job with that, how Joseph was a type of the Messiah. He saved his people, he forgave his brothers. But when the old man Jacob was dying, he blessed the boys rather than Joseph. So Joseph kind of got kicked to the curb. All the other boys got blessed, but he blessed the boys instead of Joseph. So they became essentially half-tribes. So there is no tribe of Joseph. There's Ephraim and Manasseh. I think that's it. So the tribe of Joseph is divided. And you see there in 32, of the people of Joseph, namely the people of Ephraim, he counts them, so it's 40,500 of them, and the people of Manasseh. And to this very day, because of Jacob's blessing, every Jewish father blesses his sons and daughters at night. And they bless them every Saturday morning in the synagogue. And they say, may the Lord make you like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Ephraim, and Manasseh. So Levi is not counted. You see Benjamin, you see Dan, you see Asher, you see Naphtali. Somebody start reading at 44.
It is these who were registered, each according to his ancestral house and his census taken by Moses from Aaron and the 12 princes of Israel. The total number of the Israelites was 20 years or more who were fit for military service registered by ancestral houses was 603,550.
This isn't like some vague number that's in 2,450. But now look at somebody read it 47.
The Levites, however, were not registered by ancestral tribes of the others, for the Lord had told Moses, the tribe of Levi alone, you shall not enroll nor include in the census along with the other Israelites. You are to give the Levites a charge to the ground of the commandments, without exception, and all that belongs to it. It is they who shall carry the dwelling with all its equipment and his obedient ministry. They shall therefore camp around the dwelling. When the dwelling is to move on, so that Levites shall take it down. When the dwelling is to be pitched, it is the Levites who shall set it up. Any one man who comes near it shall be put to death.
Okay. So the Levites aren't counted, they're separate. Remember, being holy is being separate. They're the priesthood. They're separate from the rest of the people. You don't count them. They're by far the smallest of the tribes, as we're going to see. But they're not counted. Only they can work in the sanctuary. With all the tents, you know, it's a tent. They can only work. They're the only ones who can light the lamps. They're the only ones who can fold things up, put the curtains up, put the altars together, get the water ready to wash their hands, bring those lambs over here, here's the knife, here's all the stuff you need. They're the only ones who can do it. When they get to the land, the Levites don't get land. Every other tribe gets land, but the Levites don't. Because God is their inheritance. They're not supposed to be concerned with land, livestock, crops. In fact, everybody has to make sure that they're fed. They would have to tithe to keep the Levites going. So when you grow, you know, you get 1,000 bushels of wheat. If you have 100 bushels, somebody pays you 100 shekels for something, you have to give 10 shekels to the Levites. And a lot of churches do that in our day. Tithe. And you tithe on your gross amount of money, not on your after-tax money. So the Levites, of course, have to take care of the sanctuary, so they have to camp right next to the tent. So they don't have to come from, you know, far away to get there. They're camped right next to it. They have to make sure the candles don't go out, everything is ready. high priest in there to go in there and say, hey, I have to work on my stuff. They have to dress him, they have to get the mikvah baths ready. This is all ministry stuff. And of course that gets carried through into Christianity, but not some way. It doesn't matter what, quote, tribe you're from, if you want to be a priest. But you see, you sort of get what's going on here. So Aaron, even though he did the golden calf and said, this is the God that brought you out of Egypt, because he was high priest, God spared him when the Levites became the priests. So they have to take things down, they have to put things up, they have to be near the tabernacle. And so somebody read 54.
Also, if
you realize
fulfill the Lord has
commanded him. So, except, remember at that base of Sinai, whatever you say will do, then they mess up. Whatever you say will do, then they mess up. Whatever you do. So now, you want the census? Here's the census. There's 603,550. The Levites are the priests. You got all the stuff. You did just what you said. So, now we go to chapter 2. Now, this is going to start getting important, so somebody start reading it too.
The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, the Israelites shall come, each in his own division, under the entrance of their ancestral homes. They shall camp around the meeting tent, and come to the summit. They camp on the east side, and set the sun on the east side.
Okay, stop there, right? Wait. I want to read that one, but don't read the rest of them. So now, everybody's going to be under a banner. Everybody's under a standard. Everybody's under a flag. Sometimes we call them ensign, a standard, a flag, a banner. According to their father's house. Now, by father, they mean the tribe name. If you're from the tribe of Gad, you got your own flag. They're all there. If you're from the tribe of Judah, you have your own flag. Jesus would have gone to where the Judah flag was, because he was one of them. Each tribe had a banner, a standard, an ensign. And that's how you knew where you belonged. So, somebody left the camp to go Christmas shopping and they had to come back and they looked to where their people were, then they remembered where they were supposed to be. Somebody said, oh, I'm just going to run over there to the Denny's and have something to eat, I'll be right back. They'd come back and find where they were supposed to be camped. So this was a big camp. So if you were from the tribe of Benjamin, you had to look to see where you were and orient yourself. The only thing you knew for sure is that the tent was in the middle, the Levites were next to the tent, next to it, and Judah was to the east of it, as the sun goes. They were the tribe of government. They had the power of government. This is the king, King David, is an example. The first king they picked was who? Saul. And he was a nightmare because he was from the tribe of Benjamin. He picked the wrong guy. Then David starts the kings of Judah. Jesus is the son of David. He's from the tribe of Judah. He's the government. He also from Isaiah. The government should be on his shoulder. He will reign forever and ever. The banners are important because according to the banner, you knew where your place was. You knew where you belonged. Now, as Christian, do you have a banner?
Yes.
That's why I like the banner. We'll get into that later, but there's several places in the scripture where it says God puts the banner up. Jesus says, when the Son of Man is lifted up, and draw all men to myself. So when you see the cross, you know that's where we belong. If you ever do the Song of Songs, it says a banner over us of love. This is a foretelling of that. If you go where you belong, we belong to that. We belong to him. They belong to their ancestral homes. This is all evolving toward Messiah. So as we go through this, he goes through where each of the tribes are camped. Now, if you want to learn this, it's awesome. Is it important for your salvation? No. It's interesting. I mean, who cares where God camped? I mean, really. If you meet God in heaven, you can say, dude, I don't care where you camped. Doesn't really matter. Right? And they got the order in which they're going to camp, and in some Bibles you can see it. And then there's also an order of when the cloud moves and the camp is going to move, how they're going to move. They move in a certain order. Not everybody just picks up and goes. And the issue is the ark is always in the middle. It's always surrounded by four tribes on each side, the Levites and Judah are always next to the ark. The government and the priests are always next to the tabernacle. So the Levites, of course, as it says there, they're the only ones that can touch anything. You know, if you're from the tribe of Gad, you can't say, oh, let me just help you put those candles away. You're going to get struck dead. In fact, you will get struck dead. If you're from a certain group of the Levites, you can carry the ark. If you're not, you'll be struck dead. We learned about Uzzah trying to keep the ark from falling down. He got struck dead. He wasn't allowed to touch the ark. And God would rather have the ark fall in the mud than be touched by an unclean beast. Anyway, so there's a certain order. You don't have to. It's not important to know that. It's like a marching order, literally. So when the cloud starts to move, the Levites go, ooh, we gotta go. The Levites start taking everything down, packing everything up. You can only come over for a long time. And then they all start moving with the ark in the middle. Yeah. And the tribe of Dan gets to go last. Now somebody read 32 through 34.
This was the center for the Israelites, taken by the ancestral covenant. The whole number of Lord Hezekiah came by company in the camp, 603,550. The Levites, however, did not know that they were the other rulers. So the Lord had commanded the Lord.
Have we heard that before? Yes.
The Israelites rejected the Lord and commanded the Lord. They did not have a mark.
So they did what the Lord commanded. You know, in Hebrew, when you repeat something, that means it's important. Like when Jesus says, Martha, Martha. And pay attention. And he says, Amen, Amen. And pay attention. So he repeats exactly the same verse. Everybody got counted, not the Levites, which means the Levites are important. So God through Moses is beating it into the heads of these people that the Levites are important. And people at this point said, yeah, we'll do whatever we can. See, that's two chapters already. It's a piece of cake. Just don't tell your Jewish friends. Chapter 3. We're going to skip the first part there because there are generations of Adam and, I mean, Aaron and Moses. Now, this is important because remember, Aaron is the high priest, the first high priest. He has the ephod, the beautiful breastplate. plate with the 12 stones. He has the things on his shoulder with the names of the 12 tribes. He has a beautiful turban that's holding in front of the Lord. And all his descendants are going to be, all the high priests are going to be descended from him. God already told them that. And remember, two of the boys were struck dead because they offered God fire. You can tell them, offer me fire. And God said, hey, let's offer him some fire. And they got struck dead. It's acceptable sacrifices and it's unacceptable sacrifices. Right? Cain and Abel. Cain picks up a bunch of fruit off the ground and some more of the apples off the tree and goes, I'll give these to God, I'm going to use these anyway. And Abel picks the firstborn of the flock. What's the equivalent for us? When you go to church and you go to your arms crossed and you go, when is this guy ever going to shut up? Not if I'm not a couple of sacrifices. Right? So you don't go. So somebody start reading it, verse 5. Oh, I forgot to say about the banners. God gets one of his names, Jehovah Nissi, or Yahweh Nissi, the God of the banners. Moses called him that back in Exodus. But this is what it's about. Because the banners organize everybody. And he's over all the banners. Banner over us is love. He's over the banners of Israel. The cross is a hard banner that's over all of us. We go to the banner just like they went to the banner. Right? You go to the cross broken and pathetic. You then go to the cross arrogantly and confidently. For us, that time is that full sacrifice. Right? Right. Okay, now somebody start reading in 5.
Now the Lord said to Moses, summon the tribes of Israel and take them down before Aaron, the priest to Aaron. They shall discharge the obligations they owe for the whole community before the tent of the community on maintaining the tabernacle. They shall have responsibility for all the spaces of the tent of the meeting and discharge the obligations of Israel by maintaining the tabernacle. We shall sign the Levites to Aaron and his sons. We have given time to make them and to them from the rest of Israel. That we will appoint only Aaron and his descendants to exercise the priesthood. Any unauthorized person who comes here shall be put to death.
Certain people do it. All the Levites are there to take care of what Aaron needs done. And nobody goes in, nobody from the tribe of Zebulon goes up and says, ooh, there's some dust on the ark, we need to go clean that. At the end of them. If God doesn't strike them dead, they have to kill them. So, they do all the functioning and furnishing of the thing. They can't have any other occupation. And of course, only the men can minister. Women don't minister. There's no women ministers. There's no women Levite priests. The Levitical women are inferior. They're by nature equal, but they're not priests. This is not like a, this is not like a gender equality thing. Everybody is of the same worth. They've got different jobs, but a Levite, if you're a Levite boy growing up, you know that you're going to be involved in taking care of the tent, the temple later. And the high priest says, go over and get me that. He didn't say, hey, go get it yourself, I'm not sick of that. You're always telling me what to do. You know, and there's hierarchy in the church. So the guy who's over here tells the guy who's over here what to do. Same idea. The guy down here doesn't say to this guy, hey, wait a minute. Go get me some coffee, just a little bit of cream, no sugar. So they're responsible for doing the things. They can't have any other occupation. So if you're a Levite boy growing up, you're being educated in the Torah, of course. You're learning all the time. But you can't say, you know what, I think I want to be a chemical engineer when I grow up. So these guys can't say, you know, when I grow up, I think I'm going to start my own store. And no, you're a Levite, you do this. And you have job security. You're the only ones that can do it. They will take care of you. They're going to make sure you're fed. They're going to make sure you have a place to live. But the actual priest is a Levite.
Yes, the Levite, all priests are Levites, but all Levites are not priests.
Right. But I mean, the guy who, like, cleans up is a Levite. Not a priest, is a Levite.
Right.
The guy who clips the wicks and, you know, fixes up the candles, got to be a Levite. John the Baptist's father, Zechariah, was a Levite priest. He was kind of a low-order priest. And when he meets Gabriel, it's his turn to do this thing called the incense ceremony in the temple, which was a real honor. Now, when he meets Gabriel, he's a Levite. And he, in fact, was also a priest. But, you know, that when somebody comes in at the end of the day to clean up the mess, it's a Levite who's doing the cleaning. But that guy's not a priest. So now, Sunday week 12 and 13, this is good. Actually, read 11 through 13.
The Lord said to Moses,
So the Levites represent the firstborn of Israel, the firstborn of all families. Not just Levites, but all families are to be consecrated to God. This is why Mary and Joseph went to the temple when little Jesus was 40 days old. Because he was the child that opened the womb, he had to be consecrated to the Lord. And God's law is, if that happens on day 40 for a boy baby, day 66 for a girl baby. So Joseph and Mary knew that on day 40, they had to be at the temple. Just like they knew at day 8, he had to be circumcised and get his name. There's no question about that. And the mother is ritualistically unclean from day 40. So Mary couldn't have gone into the temple before day 40. That's the law. If you were having a menstrual period, you couldn't go into the temple. When the period was over, or when you had your baby boy and when it was day 40, you got into the mitzvah bath, you put on new clothes, and then you went into the temple. You had to be cleansed first. If you were sick and you had a discharge from your body, you couldn't go into the temple. Whether it was blood or pus or whatever, you can't go into the temple. So, remember, the firstborn of the Egyptians is what? Still, the firstborn of the Israelites belong to God. The mirror. 3,000 people get their throats cut when they do their golden calf. 3,000 people are saved on Pentecost morning. So, the mirror parallel things. So God says, the firstborn of the Egyptians I've killed, but your firstborn are mine. And the Levites are the firstborn of all of your people. So then Moses is told to count the Levites. He's going to do this quickly. And then it goes into all the different orders of Levites. If you want to order the different orders of Levites, stop watching. were worse than monks and nuns and stuff. Like a gazillion of them. And it goes on and on and on. But, let's see. 14. Maybe they're going to do all those. So they're going to count the Levite boys, their age 1 month and up. The other ones were 20 and could fight. These were 1 month and up. There's no fighting. They're not anything to do with armies. They're not anything to do with wars. And that goes on in Israel to this day. You know, Israel has always been a state of war. But if you are an ultra-Orthodox person and probably a Levite, whether you've had your DNA tested or not, you don't go to the army. You're supposed to pray for the country, pray for the army, but you don't fight. Now, people are protesting that now, and that's probably going to change. It's not really fair. They don't get to go. They don't have to go. Everybody else has to go. All right, so now the Levites get counted, and then it goes into all the different orders. You can read those. But they're by far the smallest tribe. And then because they're the smallest tribe, God gives them this crazy arithmetic to do where everybody has to pay based on how much they outnumber the Levites. So they have to pay the tithe and they have to pay because there's more of them. And the point of this, of course, is the priests have to be supported. And it's not just money, it's crops. You know, it's livestock, it's, you know, Jesus kind of makes fun of them when they say, you know, you tie all your spices and all your stuff if you don't understand the law. Because when you have so many rules, it leads to what's called legalism. You go, I have to do this exactly like this, or I'm not doing good. You know, put the candle in the right place and stand in the right place. That's not good movies. That's bad for movies. But anyway, so they have to support the priestly class. There's a lot fewer Levites than any of the other tribes, by far. And this is really. They go through this again later in this book where they do another census. And they've grown a little bit because they've been in the wilderness longer. Same idea. And Aaron's kind of in charge of this. And interestingly, when we don't have to go through these orders, but all the orders are based on who the sons of Levi were. I mean, Levi was no big shakes. It's just his descendants were important. He was very important. Remember, Judah was the biggest creep of them all. He gets to be the ancestor of the Messiah. And he's one of the people who always goes. He's a big milestone. He's always arrogant. And he's the ancestor of the Messiah. Of course, Joseph has maybe been disappeared. And these orders are, like I say, you can read about them. Then they count Levites who are older, and then the tradition develops that at age 25, they do a 5-year internship as a priest, and then their ministry actually starts when they're 30, and goes until they die, they get the command. But when they're 30, they're a full-blown priest. Yes. And then so does John the Baptist. And John the Baptist, you know, is 6 months older than Jesus, basically. You know that. Who writes all this? So, He comes out into, John comes out into the wilderness just before Jesus comes on the scene. Before that, he didn't know what he was doing. Yeah, he went to Dennis, he went to the locust grand slum. He said, you know, I'm no sure if he was from Hunter. Good question. The other thing to keep in mind is when the ark has to move whenever the cloud moves. Remember, the Shekinah glory cloud was always right over the ark. The base of it was on the mercy seat. That is the very presence of God on top of the ark. So if the cloud lifted up and started to move, that meant the camp had to move. And so there were very specific instructions. Aaron and his sons were the only one that were allowed to touch the ark. They covered it. They got it ready to go. Some of them could do with the poles, but only the high priest could touch the ark. So then lesser priests came, like Pat friends. And then lesser priests came and, you know, put the candles and started taking down the curtains. Then the next group, they start taking down the fence. You know, there's different levels that do less important things, but everything is important. And everybody knows what their job is. You know, kind of like an ant hill or a beehive. Everybody knows what their job is. And everybody else knows that they can't go back to Africa. I mean, you're going to teach your kids from the time they're born that, you know, when you see things are moving, you don't go and say, hey, can I put those candles away for you? Or hey, can I help you carry that ark? Or survive. I mean, you will physically die. If you wouldn't look at it that way, because you go, oh, God, love you. If I kill people, I don't know what we're seeing. Death is a very important part of this. There were 8,580 people, all men, that were involved in packing up the ark, or packing up the tent and moving. Yeah, almost 8,600 men involved. Just in taking it down, moving it, and setting it up again. Buzzing around like little bees. And you can read about all this stuff, and there's like water of bitterness and curses and just things you have to. It's nice to know. We're learning the highlights here. Because the main thing is, as you learn in Exodus, all these things were built so God could live with the people. The whole thing is about living with the people. So everything was made for that. When the temple's made, the Shekinah cloud fills the temple when Solomon dedicates it, and everybody has to get out because you can't see. The cloud fills the temple. You can't minister, you can't do anything, you can't do sacrifices, you can't even say the prayers. Everybody has to go out of the building. And remember, tabernacle is the same word as tent. It's the tent. This is a tent. While the tabernacle is a tent. It's the same idea. And because, and this is carried into the New Testament, can you think of a place that we already studied that talks about that? John chapter 1. John's Gospel. Chapter 1. Somebody turn to it. somebody read verse 14. Somebody read it real loud.
The word is in the book. It's the Lord's name. And the Father is glory. The glory is the Father is in the book. The Lord is in the book.
So, John talks about the Word was with God, the Word was God, Word with capital W. Jesus is Word. This is Word. He says the Word became flesh. This is what we're about to celebrate. And dwelt among us. Where does that come from? Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10 to 14. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and call his name Emmanuel. Now, is Jesus' name Emmanuel? No, what does Emmanuel mean? God with us. Remember, L is the important part of every name. Emmanuel, God living with us. Jesus is God living with us. In a very real way, not just in some mystical presence, not like the cloud. In a very real way that we're used to. And you could go up to him like this. You could touch him. It wasn't like your hand would go through him. In John's first letter, with his epistle, he says we touched him, we heard him, we felt him. We saw him. We experienced him with all of his senses. Right? They were together a long time. So this passage here in John, where it says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, the Greek word there is not dwelt, it's pitched his tent. It pitched his tent with us. Tabernacle with us. So God says, I'm going to live with you in this tabernacle. Jesus is going to live with us in this tent. Like we have. You know, in that passage from Isaiah, nobody in human history would say a virgin is going to conceive and bear a son. That's not human experience. Right? If you saw a young girl who was pregnant and she said, I've not been with any man, you would immediately know she was lying. Right? That's the only way it can happen. So this is out of human experience. But Isaiah, 700 years before, says a virgin will conceive and bear a son. And you're going to name him Emmanuel. Gabriel tells Mary, you're going to have a son, and you're going to name him Yeshua, because you're going to deliver the people from his sins. That's what his name means. And Mary probably thought that. I wonder if she thought that, because she wasn't educated, but I wonder if she thought about Isaiah 7. Why did the divine word? So, the tent. He's living here in a tent. So, 8,600 people almost just to move all the stuff. And when we talked about the feast of tabernacles, tabernacle and tent, we're living in temporary dwellings. We get pretty hyped up about these dwellings. But all we are is clay pots. We know that in 2 Corinthians, Paul says, we are clay vessels of glory dwelling inside of us. The devil wants you to think about the pot, not the glory. The devil wants you to be all hyped up about the fact that your cholesterol 2 points higher than it was last year. Who cares? Your glory living inside of you. But the devil wants you to keep concentrating on your body. Hey, what about this? Hey, what about that? So now two cool things happen in chapter 6. One is this concept of the Nazarite. A Nazarite was a holy man. John the Baptist was a Nazarite. I don't want to say the last one because there was some, he was the last one practicing. He was a Nazarite. A Nazarite was somebody that didn't necessarily have to be a Levite, but they just dedicated their whole life to prayer. They were kind of like monks. And they never cut their hair. They never shaved their beard. And they wouldn't eat anything that came from a grape. In case there was fermentation on the skin of the grape. And there'd be a little bit of alcohol. And a razor never touched them. And they also, of course, the reason for that was their thinking was that wine would inflame your passions. And they were trying to get rid of their physical stuff. And they were kind of like monks. And their hair was supposed to remind them of their vow of holiness. And they couldn't go anywhere near a dead body. Now, everybody was contaminated by it if they touched a dead person. You were ritualistically unclean for a week. It didn't matter who it was, So if you were, you know, if they were standing in line at Wendy's and some guy fell over dead in front of them, they would go.
Somebody had to be unclean.
Right. Because somebody's thinking, hey, tomorrow's the Sabbath. Tomorrow's the Sabbath. If I touch this guy, I can't go to the synagogue. Can't go to church if I touch this guy.
That's
right. The guy died in the fire. Was all right. So those were the Nazarites. And if a Nazarite did what he thought was a sin, they'd shave their hair all off and start all over again. But this was kind of like a, you know, mental, you know, strengthening themselves. It was like a prayer. It was a way of life that John the Baptist was one. He was one wild looking dude.
And
No. But there is one interesting thing I remember last. And the second important thing in chapter 6 is the Aaronic blessing. Now, if you read the chapter 6 under that thing about Nazarites, no razor shall come on his head, locks of his hair grow long, separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, neither for his father, nor for his mother, nor for brother or sister if they die, shall he make himself unclean. In other words, your parents die, your brother and sister die, you don't touch them. It doesn't matter who it is, you can't touch a dead body. All the days of his separation he is holy to the Lord. And the other important part of chapter 6 is down in verse 22, which is the Aaronic blessing. Many people know the Aaronic blessing. You hear it on TV a lot. You hear it in synagogues a lot. You hear it everywhere. There are many, well, we know one Catholic priest who ends all his prayers and even ends the Mass with the Aaronic blessing after he does the regular blessing. He doesn't end his prayers. But in chapter 6, verse 22, this is the root of it. Somebody 22 to the end there. So this is how you bless the Israelites with this prayer. It's used, still used to this day. Right. Yeah. If you watch Christian TV, you'll see a lot of evangelists that will close their finger fist. And when you bless them, the rabbi or whoever it is puts his hands like this. I can't do it. It's like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. And they'll put their hands like this. And they'll form what looks like the letter Shin, which is the first letter of the prayer. So this is how you invoke God's name other people. Chapter 7 has a lot of stuff which in chapter 7 goes on forever. You can have like 700,000 verses. Oh no, 89 verses. Isn't exactly the whole thing. But basically the only important part of chapter 7 is Moses hears God talking when he's by the ark. Moses, God talks to Moses from the ark. Moses goes into the tent. When he comes out, his face glows. Remember, we did that. He goes in there and God talks to him like you talk to a friend. Moses doesn't get like some internal word, still small voice, like the rest of us get. When the Lord talks to you, you get like something in your head, tells you something. He talks like you talk to another person. So that's the Aaronic blessing. So Moses talks to God in the tent. God is physically present on the mercy seat. Now in chapter 8, which is going to wrap this up, they consecrate all the Levites. Remember now, this is all sort of going, they don't really know what's going on. Everything's been built, everything's put in place. They've gotten all these instructions. This is like the first time they're doing all this stuff. After, you know, a few more years, it's all past. But now they're just kind of doing it. So all the Levites come in front of a whole community. In other words, that's a symbol that they're separated from everybody. The Levites, God keeps emphasizing that the Levites are special people. They're separated from everybody else. They're not like everybody else. Now, are they sinners? Yes. Are some of them total freaks? Yes. Are some of them dishonest? Yes. And why do they know that? Because they're human. They're not, you know, anything special, but you know, God only uses holy people to do things, nothing would ever look up. So they're brought in front of the whole community, and as a sign that they're going to be clean, their bodies are shaved, and they're washed with water, they do sacrifices for their sin, and now they're ready to minister. Remember when we study Hebrews, the writer says, the priests have to do sacrifices for their own sins, and then for the sins of the people. It's just understood. Jesus is our eternal high priest, doesn't have to offer sacrifice for himself, right? Because in heaven he's getting something. He can just come in and help himself up for us. Aaron was pretty much in a mess. He had to do a sacrifice for himself first. That's the only thing that he had to do with God. So they're set apart. And so the Israelites all lay hands on the Levites. Say, you're the priests. We're praying for you, but you gotta deliver us. You have to represent us before God. The whole congregation of Israel. Then they get this, and this is what's important here. In chapter 8, verse 12. How are the Levites' sins removed? They lay their hands on the bulls. Their sins are transferred to the bull. The bull is killed and their sins atoned for. Did the bull have anything to do with what the Levites' sin was? Did the bull know anything about sin? But the innocent bull gets killed. Later they're going to do the lamb. You know, some normal people get a lamb. Most people get a lamb. Most times your sacrifice is a lamb. You lay your sin on the lamb. You lay your hand on the lamb, your sin's transferred to the lamb. The lamb's killed and your sin's gone. This is all preparation. This is all prefigurement of the cross. Innocent victim. Everybody's sin was put on him. He had nothing to do with the sin. But he dies for the sin. Pretty amazing. This is what it's preparing them for. I'm pretty soon when they're all converted and realize this, and I say, how did we miss all this? How did we miss all this? So now everything is set up. The blood sacrifice is like the drug. It's like an muscle. And it's disgusting. Why is it bloody mess when disgusting? The skin is bloody mess when disgusting.